This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We're on remote with Caroline Bock, and she's a novelist with a new book. Caroline, you are getting praise heaped over you all over the country. What's the title of this book?
The Other Beautiful People.
And what in the world is in it? Because you're making news.
Well, thank you, Grace. First of all, I just love being here with you. I really
Me
do.
Me too. So this is our, this is girlfriend time.
Thank you. But The Other Beautiful People is, first of all, set at the Cinema Channel, which is a beloved but struggling cable network. And I know you've worked in television too, so I hope we'll have a chance to talk about that. And it's set as a in the weeks after 9/11 in Midtown Manhattan. And as you know, it's the 25th anniversary coming up of September 11th. And I think that has elevated the entire conversation around the book. I also think it's at the heart of it, it's a book about a working woman, a career woman, a driven woman who is at the point of, as one reviewer said, combusting. She is being pulled between her work family and her home family. And I think it's a dilemma a lot of women have faced. And that's what I'm hearing back from readers. And it's only been out a month. I mean, it's only been out since June 2nd. And I feel people have taken a really deep dive into it already.
Well, you've plugged into my guilt. You sure plugged into my anxiety. Every woman, I don't care how carefully they mothered or nurtured, has that awful feeling when they were working. And there is something so universal and so compassionate about that, that the book nurtures as well as it reveals what it's like, what it's like. And it almost exonerates us for being late for supper. But I find that I like it for certain reasons. The critics like it because it has family, it has values, it has action and adventure. What do you like about it? That it's done?
Definitely that it's done. That I was able to write another novel, which I really thought I would never write. I have written two YA novels that were very well received. And I thought, and then a book of short stories. And I thought, you know, maybe I had said all I had to say. Of course, I had this yearning to keep writing and this moment in my life, because this is drawn very close to my life. It's the closest thing I've ever written to my own being and time as a career woman after 9/11.
I want people to know that the other novels, one was a young adult novel, L.I.E., and Before My Eyes, that were both of them St. Martin's Press?
Yes, they're both St. Martin's
Press. That's a good one. And then you had an award-winning short story. If it's not an award, you don't want to bother writing it, I know. It was called Carry Her Home. Yes. So before we make any more judgments about this, can you read a bit of it? And set up the first reading for us.
Sure. I thought I would just start by reading the first page. It's set in December of 2001, so weeks after 9/11. And it's set actually in Silver Spring, Maryland, where the main character, Amy Green, who is a marketing and PR executive at the Cinema Channel, has moved to or found herself. So it opens at midnight, and I'll just start it. So, The Other Beautiful People. Before I start making a Sunday night list, before I slip out my BlackBerry and obsess about it being my second night here, I should go upstairs to Jack. Except before I can jump off this porch swing, the BlackBerry pulses. Owen's rule, no calls after midnight, and it's him. We don't need small talk. We've had 20 years of talk in the office, over lunches, on planes, and hotel bars, and if I'm keeping score, not much less than with Jack. These days, Owen stars as the general manager. A new logo and tagline, he says. The Cinema Channel, America's Art House. I can't think of a logo and tagline now, can I? But what I say is, funny, I was thinking of it too. I'm wearing a company t-shirt. As the head of marketing and public relations, I have dozens. But the only one I could find in the sprawl of unpacked boxes is the oldest. Oversized, unisex, circa 1981. The logo in red slashed across white, Cinema Channel. I always wanted to be Katharine Hepburn. All sharp retorts, square jaw, and tight lips. I'm no Hepburn, and Owen's no Spencer Tracy. My hair, a mad mess, resists being pinned up. Even back in Manhattan, this December has been cool, not cold, as if none of us can move on, not even the weather. Why did I think I could live anywhere but Manhattan? A moon must be above all these plumes of trees. Stars somewhere, just not the kind of stars I usually think about.
Oh, Caroline, one thing I want people to know is it is so lyrical. I mean, you're not even a poet. I don't know what you think you're doing, but it is the imagery is absolutely beautiful. The scenes of New York City, the smells, the sights, the tastes. I gave it to a New Yorker and just to vet you, and you have nailed it. I mean, your description, even the first page where you set up a time and place with the old t-shirt, so good. So how did she learn all this? She studied creative writing at Syracuse University with the great Raymond Carver, Tess Gallagher, Tobias Wolff, Jack Gilbert. She has an MFA from the City College of New York, but it comes from just writing years after years. And I know it's a success because I was an intern, anxious, nervous, excited, eager to read more, a nervous wreck to make the train on time. I'll tell you, when did you know that the lived life in you had to be said? What, it must have been incubating for years, and then all of a sudden you said, I have got to tell this story. When was that?
Oh, such a good question, Grace. It really was toward the end of the pandemic, where I had, like many people, this incredible loneliness. And I said, well, I'll just try writing about 500 words a day. I had joined an online writing community. And I said, 500 words, I could do that. And I can do something I never thought I would do, but write about this time in my life, these weeks after 9/11, this time where I was so torn between being this very, very driven executive and my family at home. And I thought I would never really go there because I had so many other places to go. I had a traumatic childhood I had already written about. And I was like, I should write something fun. I should write a thriller or a romance. And I said, no, time is
this has all of that. This has a little bit of each. You got your wish.
It does have the romance. It does have the romance. It does have the love
thrilling
story.
When you miss the train, it's kind of thrilling.
Yes. Well, especially the Amtrak, especially at a Penn Station. And I thought, well, no, I have to just write, give myself permission to write this novel and dive and immerse myself back into the time where I had all these people around me. And I still felt lonely, but it was a different type of loneliness as a person. And so ironically, the writer loneliness went away being immersed back in 25 years ago.
Well, what was the first thing you did to start the novel? I mean, here you have the memories, there you've got the paper and the computer. What is the first thing you do to start the novel? Do you do research? Do you write the first sentence? Do you dream?
I did not write the first sentence. This first sentence and opening has been rewritten several times from there. But I thought back to, what did I do? I think what I did was really close my eyes and think, what is it like to be back in Manhattan? Because I love Manhattan. I loved working there. I loved living there. I like DC where I live now. It has been very good to my family, and I'm grateful for that. But that rat-tat-tat life of being in the city, of being in charge, of being in the middle of things, of being on the streets. Remember, I'm writing this where I'm sitting in my office in suburban Washington, D.C. alone. So I actually, one of the first scenes I wrote was walking through Penn Station and this idea that it was a Warren and the idea that I was back on the Amtrak and that I was just in the middle of life when I felt at that moment I wasn't.
So you ran it like a film in your eyes and then got it to the paper. Did you work daily on this? Did you have a discipline, a time that you said from 8 to 10, I'm going to do this no matter what Sarah wants?
Sarah being my wonderful musician daughter.
Her famous musician daughter.
Yes.
Did you write every day or did you? You had to have a discipline. Yes. A novel is such a long journey.
Yes, and which is why I sometimes wish I was a poet, because I would be done. So maybe. I don't want to underestimate poets. I so admire them all. I did write every day. I'm a morning writer. I am a get up and write almost from my dreams. It felt like with this novel, because I started dreaming it. And I was there in my dreams so I could wake up in the morning and be there on the page. Oh. And if I could put 500 words down, it was great. If I put 1,000 words, I cheered, but I was at it in the same way I always do any work.
Oh my.
You know, steady progress. But again,
what was the chronological? Did you chronologically do it like in frames? Like think of, this was the first week, and that was the next month. Did you try to follow a timeline, or was it done pointillistically?
It was done pointillistically. It was done in fragments. It was done as flash fiction to start with. And then only when I hit about 50,000 words did I realize I had a novel and it had to happen. And then I started framing it and actually outlining it. So it took me about 10 revisions to pull it all together because I had these scenes. And I think that's where your instinct that it was very lyrical came out, because I was reading a lot of poetry at this time too. Again, it's the loneliness factor. And I always feel poets speak to me in a way other writers don't. Particularly Diane Zeus, who's one of my favorites. And Grace Cavalieri, of course.
Of course.
Yes.
Well, what were the ethical concerns? Because I have a theory that writing is a very moral occupation, that we're always weighing who we are identifying, what we dare to say. Were there any ethical considerations about either naming people you knew or condemning something? What did you think about?
Well, I did think about that, since this is a very autobiographical novel. I've seriously called this autofiction because probably 70% of it is absolutely happened, absolutely drawn from my life. Maybe not in this exact time frame, which makes it fiction, but definitely from my life. So everyone from the brother in the novel who shows up at key points, Maddie, that's my brother. I am 13 months apart from my brother, Mark. And he knows I write about him all the time. But when I said to him one more time, I'm writing about you, he was like, okay, what else is there left to write? And I said, so much. That's a small point. The big heart of the novel is Amy Green really grappling with the idea, is she able to love? Is she lovable? Is she, because of the trauma she had in her background, can she not combust at this moment where the world is combusting around her? And at the heart of it is a love triangle, a infidelity. I don't want to give away. I don't want to give a spoiler, but that infidelity absolutely happened. I've been married for 41 years to the same guy, and he's a good guy. And I had to say to him, I was writing about this point in my life when I had a work spouse, when I had a secret love. And I had him read the book, early versions.
Well, what was your biggest fear? Was that your biggest fear in all of this writing? Or was it that you wouldn't get published? Or was it what your family would think?
No, I didn't worry about getting published or not at that point. I felt I had to write this novel, that it was that important to me, which was actually a good thing, because then I put all the commercial concerns to the side for this time, you know, the year. It took me about a year to get a good first draft of this down on paper. And the fear was I wanted to honor this memory. I wanted to honor the people I worked with. I wanted to capture this character who was so drawn on myself, but not myself. I always say
it's all fiction, but the feelings. Feelings were true as rain. So,
and with novels, you want to always heighten the stakes. You know, so the stakes have to be as high as possible all the time. So as you said, you want to turn the page. And once I realized I had a novel, I did go through and say, you know, is this, you know, what else could happen to this character? What other decisions does she have to make? Where, you know, is she fully immersed in this world? Does she feel it on her skin?
And you talk about auto fiction. I don't think many people know what that means. Is it a new term?
It's a term of art. I mean, the French use it, of course, more than we do, as they do several literary terms. But it means autobiographical novel. It means you're really drawing on your life, and you're not hiding it. I'm not hiding it to anybody that I worked for 20 years in cable television. I worked at Bravo and IFC, was part of the executive team that launched it. This could not be anything but autofiction in my mind, or autobiographical novel.
It just rings like the first light of morning. It is absolutely full of truth. And that is why it's lyricism and truth go together, you know. So what is the difference between writing this long, purging, self-identifying, and yet epitomized story compared to writing for a young adult, which you have a very popular book for young adults? This, first of all, we forgot to say the title again. The present novel is called The Other Beautiful People. And this, and the children's novel was L-I-E?
L-I-E or lie. You're giving away your New York background, Grace, to say L-I-E. That title was initially L.I.E. Very clued into L-I-E because it's set on Long Island. And the Long Island Expressway, which is what that means, is a huge metaphor in that novel. The young people try to escape their small town on Long Island, but they go east. And of course, what happens when you go east on Long Island? You hit Montauk or the end. You can't get off. So there's lots of metaphors. But at the end of the day, my editor at St. Martin's and I agreed that it was a little too inside to call it L period, I period, E period.
Oh.
Periods off. But oh. All New Yorkers call it L-I-E.
I know. Well, read us another segment of the beautiful, the other beautiful people, which is becoming quite a sensation.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Grace. So this also draws on just my being a New Yorker, the other beautiful people. And in this section, I thought I would dive into 9/11, since the anniversary is coming up. And since I was based in New York at that time. So this is page 9. And Amy Green, the main character, is leaving her office building and she's unable to reach her husband, Jack, who coincidentally that day had an interview down at the World Trade Center. Coincidentally, in real life, my husband was on the A train underneath the World Trade Center at about 8:15 in the morning, a train he didn't usually take to Brooklyn, but took that day. So Amy is now leaving the office, and this is what she thinks. She's in Midtown Manhattan. Out on the streets, I headed east, afraid of the buildings, of their height. I'd never been afraid of a building before. I always watched skyscrapers being built. They started like archaeological digs with huge holes in the ground, steel girders hammered into the very bedrock of Manhattan. Sirens, sirens, sirens. That morning, the South Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed. Somewhere in western Pennsylvania, a field, a hill, an ordinary flight from Newark was wrestled to the ground. Later, we learn that the passengers were the bravest folks ever. I often think of what I would have done if I had been on that plane. Then the North Tower of the World Trade Center collapsed. Sirens, sirens. On First Avenue, as I headed toward the apartment, I was pushed off into the sidewalk, into the street, and hurried with others between cars and taxis. Buses were at a standstill. Someone said the UN was evacuated. Everywhere, people stabbed at their dead cell phones, or were crying, or panicking, or without expression, like some freakish 1950s horror movie. I stumbled against a hard hat construction worker. Sweat slithered down the side of our faces, our grim determination, since we were New Yorkers, our tears, since we were human. We held one another's hands briefly. Sirens. I ran through the apartment, and since it was only 4 rooms in that damn apartment, that took me a second to do twice. Racing past Jack's manual typewriters on display on the bookshelves lining our 12-foot wide living room, as if expecting to find him there, writing up some op-ed or speech. I found his 3-word handwritten note, which had slid off our bed into the dust falls on the roof.
Mm.
Jack was wedged between the water tower and the ledge, wearing only gym shorts and flip-flops.
Mm.
His pale legs, scrubby, damp chest, and generous, doughy belly were exposed. His bald head and glasses glistened. The first thing he said to me was, "Don't be mad at me." The next thing he said was, I shoved the interview suit and shirt and tie and shoes, both shoes, never got them shined, shoved it all down the garbage chute, They're covered in dust or DNA. In dust. Let's agree it was dust. I showered twice. Dust. I reached Adam, their son. Insisted he stay in Syracuse, he said. A wind and specks, dust, not DNA, flew off his glasses. I reached my parents, insisted to them. I don't know what I insisted to them. I was alive. They wanted us to leave the city tonight and stay with them. Dust, not DNA. We were up on the roof for hours. This wasn't any scene from any movie I'd want to see. The streets emptied. The skies were choked with the sickly twilight of plastic burning. Sirens wailed. Sirens wound up and released like bomb bursts. And helicopter and fighter jets and more sirens streaked across the sky. That night, the last thing he said was, "Don't ask me about what happened this morning." Mm. Not ever. I stroked his face, ashen and older than that morning. He turned away from me.
That is partly a blood pressure raise. And was that hard to write? That was the hardest thing to write because you really had to go back there.
Right. Because my husband, while he did not get off that A train, I could not reach him. I learned later that he saw it all out the window of his office building in downtown Brooklyn, all of what happened. He ran down 10 flights of stairs, ran into the streets with people covered from dust. Mm-hmm. He was covered with dust as a result.
That word, dust. You even have the word dust by itself, yes, with a period. Very emphatic. It says everything. Well, we know a little bit about what you are as a writer, and I think it's really important for people to know your preceding life, which was an executive, and you began actually one cable company. So where did you work in New York? I know you were a marketing executive, and you had to have... That was outward bound, I'm sure. But how did you get into cable?
Well, I went to Syracuse University, as you said, and I always thought I'd be a writer. But because I had my practical side, I went there on a full academic scholarship. I majored in English, and I also majored in communications at the S.I. Newhouse School of Communications. And I had this wonderful opportunity to study with people like Raymond Carver and Tess Gallagher and Jack Gilbert and Tobias Wolff. And it was all fabulous. But being a scholarship kid from this single parent working class background, I was like, I don't know if I could go straight into grad school, which is where everybody else in my peer group was going. And I had applied. I applied to Iowa, I applied to Columbia and all the big schools. And I got in and I thought, I'll take a year and I'll work and then I'll go to grad school. And I got into Manhattan and I applied for a had a friend who said, "Oh, there's a job open at USA Network." They had just moved from New Jersey to Manhattan, so they were really young too, and they're looking for a publicity assistant. And literally, this was in 1985, I walked in, had my resume, which I had typed on my Selectric typewriter, and I said, "I'm here for the publicity assistant job," and they were like, "Oh, well, let me see, you know, if they have time to talk to you." And I was like, okay. And I sat there in my little interview suit, my only suit I owned. And they said, "Sure, we'll talk to her." This is without a call beforehand. This was without anything, Grace. And I walked in, I had my resume, and a guy named Barry Kluger, who went on to be head of MTV in the day. PR, and Jamie Padnos and Mark Braff were sitting there with boxes all around them, and they said, well, you know, can you type? And I was like, you betcha, I could type 100 words a minute. I had no idea how much I could type. And you went to Newhouse. Oh, and one of them said, my wife went to Newhouse. Oh, and another one said, oh, and my wife's name Caroline. And they said, can you start on Monday? And I was like, sure, I could start on Monday.
Sunday even.
Right, I'll start now.
Well, how did you get from that in one sentence to be the chief executive at the independent film cinema? And how many years did it take for you to claw your way up the ladder?
I know.
Or
but
float
Grace,
your way.
It was a wild ride because everybody in those days wanted to work for broadcast television. Nobody wanted to work for cable. Nobody had heard of cable. You know, so it was the new industry. And I found myself within 6 months on the road with celebrities. Within a year, I had been promoted. Within 5 years, I was manager in the department. I am still friends with the one remaining of those three initial guys. I'm still friends with him all these years later. And I think that's also part of it, is that I like people. I'm actually... didn't even know what publicity was. I was the shy, bookish, you know, English major. But, you know, I realized that there was an opportunity there. And
also,
I said, well, I could...
Also, when you know what you... You're very passionate. And when you know what you want... There's really no stopping you. I mean, you're a laser beam, and that's a good thing. It's a good thing because I cannot see you staying the assistant publicity director at all. But I want to go to let people know what you're doing now,
right.
Which is juggling many things.
Yes, but I stayed at USA 5 years, but my big move was to go to another new, another job after 5 years, which was to Bravo and AMC, these were the old Bravo and AMCs, where they showed movies uncut and commercial free, where they showed arts programming, which they were struggling. It was all about putting on a show. And I was suddenly again in my element because I was working for an arts channel and a movie channel that I loved. And with people who were very supportive. And I did put my writing again on hold. I kept putting it on hold, thinking there would be time. And suddenly I went from manager to director to senior vice president to the part of the executive team that did things like launched IFC and launched the IFC film side called IFC Films. And
there's something about being at the beginning of something, too.
Yes.
That does a lot.
Right.
You happen to be the beginning of all of these things in cable.
Yes. And you know that too, from starting more than one project on your side, that excitement. And so I was working 6-7 days a week often. And that's where this character, Amy Green, comes from. And now you could say, well, how did you ever leave that job? Well, one day I realized I was 35 and married for 17 years to this wonderful guy, and maybe we should have a family, right? And then I had my son, and I was still working 60, 70 hours a week. And then life caught up to me by my end of my 30s, where I had two parents who were both very ill, where I had this beautiful little boy where I really wanted a second child, and it wasn't happening in a big way. Several miscarriages. And I thought, well, you can't keep doing the same thing you've been doing. Oh, and remember that dream you had about being a writer? Maybe now is the moment as I hit 40, was time to grab hold of it. And I quit, just like that. I gave him 2 weeks' notice after 20 years and said, I need to focus on my family. I need to focus on being a writer. I need to focus on other dreams.
Well, you are now the co-publisher of the Washington Writers Publishing House, and you have edited major anthologies such as America's Future, Capital Love, and you are the prose editor at the Washington Writers Publishing House. So is this enough for you? What do you do?
Oh, great.
I mean, after being an executive in New York and commuting to Silver Spring with cold pizza in your hand and losing your briefcase and having a love affair and all of these things, is it enough now to just be running a publishing house and all these anthologies and teaching workshops? Is it good?
I don't know. You tell me. I look at you as a model of someone who just
is. Don't do that, honey. Going. You'll never sleep again. You'll never sleep again. Well, you know, what? Another thing we need people to know before we hear a final reading is that you do manage to insert parts of film, parts of characters, little pieces of dialogue, and even using the page itself as a script with a blackout and a cut. So you're in the industry. You get us to be in the industry. When did that idea come to you?
Well, I think as I start shaping this and thinking of the characters, I've always thought of the people in my life often as if I'm watching a movie, as if I'm observing a movie. I mean, John Gardner says, be a camera. And I sometimes felt like that was in me, that I'm looking at the world as this observer. Mm. And I had Amy as a way that she sees the world is through seeing it like she's the camera too. Mm. So she sees, you know, parts of her life fade out and fade in and cut quickly and speed up. And then I thought, I had one character I started describing as Slim, which was Lauren Bacall's nickname. She was tall and slim, Lauren Bacall and Humphrey Bogart. And I described this character that way because in real life, this is based on a real life wonderful friend I have, she's only 4'10". And when I said, Kim, I'm writing about you, she said, you can write about me, but one thing, you must make me tall. And so I said,
writers can do anything. Writers don't make any money, but they can transform the world and change the narrative, which you have. And we want a final reading.
Okay, Grace. So, but thank you for bringing up the classic movie references because I loved writing them. That was so much fun. It was just, and I'm a huge movie fan.
I wonder if you will start a little syndicated column on movie reviewing. We need a female reviewer. Of course, I don't know if you have time to see everything that comes out, but if I know you, you can expand time.
Thank you, Grace.
I'd love to get your take on film.
Yes, I do theater reviews for a wonderful group called the DC Theater Arts website. So I'm already reviewing. Okay. But movies, wow, that would be something too. I'll
there have to go think your about. Sundays. There go your Sundays. Here's a final reading.
And this reading is for everybody who's ever taken the Amtrak, particularly from New York to DC. So the main character, Amy Green, is on the Amtrak, and this is in, as we remember, the weeks after 9/11. And this is not only about the Amtrak, but one of my great loves in life. So, there's smoke on the Amtrak. They're pulling into Newark, which is the first station outside Penn Station on the Northeaster going from New York to DC. And this is what happens. After a long moment, we all hear the commotion, the swoosh of extinguishers, the pounding, the screaming, the shouting, the screeching like hungry, desperate cats clawing at one another. The Newark night cleaves to us, and we move nearer to one another, except Headphone Kid. He's going to run. The culprit is dragged out of the last car by his scruff onto the platform. He's squealing that he only wanted to take a goddamn dump, have a goddamn smoke. The goddamn lighter, get your fucking hands off of me. I'm going to fucking sue every one of you. Between the two firefighters, the drunk howls, heaves, and vomits on his gray suit pants and their jet black boots. We back off and we groan loudly and comically. Even the Headphone Kid, who I spot slinking at the edge of the crowd, is wide-eyed at the spectacle. The broadest fireman orders the drunk to sit down and behave. Two other big shoulders make sure he's down on the platform. The police are on the way, announces one, who says it like, why bother? We got this, don't we? These first responders are ready for their close-up. And we burst out in cheers. The firefighters acknowledge us with the barest and coolest of nods. A few of the younger ones offer us bashful grins. One touches his hand to his helmet. I can't unfreeze my eyes from them, and neither can anyone else. We want to have heroes these days. Tonight, it's these firefighters. It all happens so fast and well efficiently. I wonder what they will tell their wives or girlfriends when they get home, whether it's tonight or tomorrow or whenever firefighters go home. Will they say, just another fire coming into Newark? Just another drunk? Will they be as fixed and certain as they seem right at this moment when they ease into bed next to their lover? Will they be ready to make love? Will they cover their partner's bodies with their own as hard and ready as they are right now? Or will they become soft in their lover's arms? Will they cry out their pain? Will they wonder about the ugliness of life? The boots that will need to be cleaned from vomit? Or will they gaze at their lover and think, I am alive? Have they thought this 100 times since 9/11? Have they thought, I am ready to fuck or make love, ready to smother the flames of discontent in me by this act of making love, because it has been a very long night with a fire on the train and a drunk and those passengers, they don't know the half of it, but I am going to make love and sleep in my own bed. Sleep, so help me. No, there's nothing soft about these men, especially the oldest one. Grizzled crow feet around his eyes, his skin too red to be healthy. He catches my eye and is happy with the cheers, or himself. How I love firemen. No irony. I love them. That fireman knows what love is. I wish he'd tell me. No time. The conductor is announcing that the train is back in service.
The girl can write. Jet black boots, two other big shoulders ready for their close-up. The girl can write. The other beautiful people. This is the poet, the poem from the Library of Congress. We're with Caroline Bock. The series is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank our funders, who are Natalie Canivore, Avidesha Shani, Young Ki Kim Renault, and Sandy Jackson Cohen. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. Our guest is Caroline Bock. I'm Grace Cavalieri.